The timing of the paper comes well after Stella's, I think, although mine sort of goes from the sublime to the ridiculous. The philosophical discussions to some sort of really practical events involving various rustics in Scotland. And it also adds to the theme of reproductive control, which we've been hearing about throughout the day. So the origins of my argument really draw on this eclectic field sometimes called the social studies of reproduction. And here the claim is very simply that the sites of intervention into biological capacities to reproduce tend to be sites of intense social activity and social reproduction, whether this is in humans or animals, where in any event more than biological organisms get reproduced. So I will present a story of a controversy in the natural history of the salmon, at the center of which was a deployment of what was at the time a novel artificial reproductive technology. The time was the 1850s, broadly speaking. The technology was so-called artificial breeding, and this incorporates artificial fecundation or insemination and incubation and rearing of the young. This technology allowed a degree of biological control over the reproduction of the fish, and this control enabled an experimental program focused on their development to become possible. The central protagonists of the story are what at the time was a mysterious little fish called the parr. Well, that's the one major protagonist, and the other was a gamekeeper in Dumfries named John Shaw. The breeding of salmon and other fish by artificial means has typically been subsumed within histories of aquaculture, and this is understandable, as the eventual major use of the techniques in question would be to breed fish to restock rivers, or to supply the food industry and this kind of thing. But as is often the case with new technologies, however, their origins are different from their eventual uses. And this was the case here with the technique of manually mixing the gametes of fish, incubating their eggs, rearing their young, as I said. And in this case, it was done in order to resolve an apparently intractable problem in natural history known to contemporaries as the parr controversy. And it's this controversy, which is my theme for the day. This is a picture of artificial fecundation, as it was called. Right, so here's the culprit, the parr, or the salmonet, or the Salmo samulus, was the most common scientific name at the time. So what was this controversy all about? Put simply, it was a debate about whether a type of fish existed as a species sui generis. So as I say, this fish was commonly known as the parr, or the most ichthyologists knew it as the Salmo samulus. A number of theories about this fish existed in the general and the scientific communities. Some thought of it as a juvenile form of trout, some a juvenile form of salmon, some a hybrid of no fixed type, and still others a distinct, though very small, species of salmonid, i.e. the Salmo salmonus. Until the late 1830s, the latter was the position cleaved to by the most respected authorities. So the story I'm going to tell is largely about how this consensus was dismantled, and the Salmo salmonus came to be seen as merely a young salmon, or a parr, the colloquial name for all salmonids. So there's a great thicket of technical arguments from both sides of this coin, which is far too complex to enter into here, but I'm just going to say a couple of key points about the technical dimension of the argument. The main thing is that you have to see the controversy as an attempt to prove that the Salmo salmonus didn't exist, which is a very difficult starting position for anyone to be in. This meant, in practice, providing a plausible alternative candidate to this fish, the Salmo salmonus, or parr, and most importantly, shifting the burden of proof onto those who argued it did exist by undermining their arguments. And this is where the technology of artificial breeding is going to come into my argument. Importantly, there were no reliable or agreed upon sort of morphological, anatomical markings or characteristics to distinguish the fish in question. Everyone argued about everything, basically. The parr looked very similar to the young of all other species and varieties of trout and salmon, and it seemed, as one writer at the time put it, to lack a constant specific character. So here's some more pictures from the period. This author is trying to prove it is a distinct species, but once at the bottom of the Salmo salmonus and there's some other varieties. You see they look very similar, and the most visible, obvious characteristic are these marks, and then there's the parr mark, sometimes thought of as being like the fingers of a human hand, sometimes what they call fingerlings. So the point of the image is to show that Although there was a big controversy, it did not mean that all natural historians believed it was impossible to visibly discriminate between parr and other closely allied fish. Indeed, to the contrary, many believed they could. It was just a very difficult task, involving high esoteric skills and powers of observation that was supposedly the unique province of natural historians and specialists in this topic, many of whom, as we'll see, were deeply troubled by ceding ground in this field to amateurs. So those lacking the correct credentials in this field were considered incapable of the fine acts of discrimination necessary to recognize a true species. The abilities of, quote, practical men and Billingsgate naturalists, namely those who had labored manually or were not socially recognized gentlemen of scientific standing, were in this regard especially distrusted. In the absence of these kinds of credentials, another form of reproductive technique, I'm going to suggest, complementary to artificial breeding, was necessary to overcome a trust bottleneck and mitigate concerns stemming from the status differences amongst human actors in this debate. I want to show that language and the rhetoric in this context of empirical debate fulfill this function of an alternate reproductive technology. So a little bit more about the context. Now that we briefly met the animal, we need to meet some of the sort of social context. An important part of the debate was the growing popularity of salmon angling at the time, combined with perceptions of declines in actual salmon numbers and real declines in commercial fisheries rates during the first half of the century. This was the case on virtually all salmon Scottish producing rivers, including the Tweed and its tributaries in the Borders. These rivers were much prized for their fishing, made more so by their easy accessibility from large population centres. That's why much of the controversy centres in that area. This situation, which ultimately required legislative redress in the form of conservation legislation, was also stimulated interest in all aspects of what we might today call fisheries biology, and especially in the salmon life cycle. The identification of parr, or the Salmo salmulus, with young salmon, was a potentially explosive thing to do, as it suggested a means by which the stock may have been historically harassed. That is, young salmon were regularly taken under the belief that they were not salmon at all. And that's what much of the issue came to hinge on later on. Indeed, the parr controversy, whilst a matter of natural history proper, also had this sort of socio-political component. If the parr were proven to be no more than the young of the salmon, then what was stopping these fish being brought under the strict and penal legislation that had existed since Magna Carta for the valuable salmon species alone? If this happened, fishing for parr would no longer be more or less free and open to the public, as it generally been. Hence, there's always a hint of suspicion in this discussion about the motives of some participants in debates. And if we have time, I'll say more about this, but we may not. Unsurprisingly, salmon anglers are at the forefront of agitation around this parr issue. Anglers spend their time observing fish habits, and they also tend to ply the upper reaches of rivers, where the salmon breed and their young linger. A small cadre of literate, well-connected, in some cases famous anglers really began to agitate on this issue in the 1820s. Here's a picture of some of them. These included Sir Humphrey Davy, on the far left as you're looking at it, the chemist, who wrote a book which addressed the topic. The matter was also well known to Walter Scott, at whose house this engraving comes from. Here at Abbotsford, which was a well-known sort of meeting point of literary types and scientifically minded anglers on that part of the Tweed. Scott's acquaintance and one-time neighbour at Abbotsford was the angling writer and artist William Scrope, and he formed a definite opinion of this topic, and he lobbied Parliament in the 1820s on it. Another friend of both Scott and Scrope's, the poet James Hogg, soon took the issue in hand. This is him sitting over here. And penned an interesting article on the topic in 1832 in the Agricultural Journal. Arguing that parr were no more than young salmon, his methods included offering a dram to any fisherman who came forward with certain information he needed. So unsurprisingly, his methods were accused of, quote, taking the license of poets in general when it came to these observations. The issue was thus a talking point, is a point that I'm making, in some elite corners of society. But natural historians and zoologists too began to take an increased interest in this problem. Some strayed from the consensus. Robert Knox, the infamous anatomist, for example, believed parr to be hybrids, whose mysterious history could only be understood by his esoteric theory of transcendental biology. but most agree with the leading Scottish scholar of the Salmonidae family at the time, Sir William Jardine, also of Dumfriesshire, who declared unambiguously in the Edinburgh New Philosophical Journal in 1835 that the parr and the migratory salmon had no connection whatsoever, quote, and is best considered a salmon sumulus. So that's the consensus and more or less the starting point of what I want to say. This is Drumlanrig Castle, and this is an engraving taken in 1940, and I like to think that this chap fishing over here is my guy, but he probably isn't. So, into this picture emerges our hero. A humble gamekeeper on a sporting estate belonging to the Duke of Buccleuch in Drumlanrig on the River Nith, near whose banks he lived. Using the techniques of artificial breeding, his work did more than any other to unravel the history of the parr and arguably the salmon at this time. What did he do, and how did he eventually succeed in convincing his scientific commentators? In a series of three papers between 36 and 40 in Edinburgh Scientific Society journals, John Shaw attempted, by means of experimental testimony, artificial breeding, and the careful deployments of the rhetoric of empiricism, to dismantle the belief that parr were a sui generis species and anything other than a young salmon. Right. This is an image from one of his texts, and it more or less shows his method. That's an egg the day before hatching, and that's a salmon of 2 years old. And he's showing that what everyone thought was a parr was the same thing as that. That's the whole thing in a nutshell. So his approach was novel, and this is the important point. It centered on the observation of captive fish in controlled circumstances, rather than on descriptions of captured wild specimens. This fundamental contribution was thus to place the process of salmon development from fertilization onwards under direct observation for the first time, whilst adopting novel techniques to ascertain the actual parentage of these specimens. He focused on showing continuity in the life cycle of the salmon, not on laborious comparisons between non-existent parr and young salmon, or what to him were non-existent parr. So, here's another picture, slightly later, but also taken from fish from John Shaw's ponds, and he's showing the same point. When you scraped off the scales, you'd see those marks underneath the salmon. And this was rather controversial at the time, because his approach, I think, challenged the privilege and abstruse skills of visual identification upon which the naturalist status was based. Moreover, he eventually transformed the debate from one about resemblances and descriptions to one about sexual descent and relatedness as the basis for claims about species identity. Shaw's theory, though, met with immediate and stiff resistance from the scientific elite. As one said, his observations go contrary to all that has previously been entertained on the subject. Isn't a letter that one of the naturalist friends of Sir William Jardine wrote in 1836. So doing this, bringing this controversial new theory to the topic, a new way of approaching the theory to the topic, and doing so as a gamekeeper without any recognized book-based education of any sort, he was quickly labeled a menace, who worryingly was proving capable of converting, quote, nearly the whole tribe of amateurs, as one could put it. A supporter of John Shaw's in later years described the attitude of a prominent journal to him as expressing no nobler feelings toward him than to sneer at the practical man. So Shaw was well aware of these attitudes towards him and his alleged facts. In his paper of 38, he discussed the difficulties in researching migratory fish that, quote, alike beset the path of the learned and the unlearned. But he continued, there is another difficulty which more particularly presses upon the latter, and that is the skepticism with which his observations are generally regarded by scientific inquirers. And this is where artificial fecundation comes in more directly. This, incidentally, is a picture of the detail from one of his articles that describes his breeding system and his incubation beds and ponds and how they are isolated from the river system. So Shaw's earliest experiments met with one particular criticism, that since he had only collected fertilized spawn from the fish from the river and reared these into parr, which he could then observe in his ponds, he could not be sure of the real parentage of those eggs, and perhaps he had just collected salmon eggs and reared up salmon, not a very original thing to do. So it was at this point, in the words of another later admirer, that he, quote, took to a plan that seems almost miracle-working, imitating by human agency the creative powers of nature. And Mr. Shaw resorted to it with little hope, but as a desperate endeavor to put cavillers to silence. So he's resorting to a new scientific technique because of criticisms, and I'm arguing that these criticisms were aimed at him because of his status, to a certain extent. This was the use of artificial fecundation, the new technique, which had hardly ever been seen in Britain before, though its technique had been described in books translated from German a couple of decades earlier. Shaw, however, faced an almost insurmountable problem in his attempt to prove his case. Not only were his personal credentials in doubt, but he was in effect being asked to prove a negative, we may say that in retrospect at least. Thus, his critics suggested he might be admired for having shown something interesting about salmon in the process of trying to breed them, that, quote, the additional proposition that the PAR does not exist, as one editor put it in 1840, is extremely questionable. In other words, he could be doing all these wonderful things with salmon, but the real Salmo salmonus is still out there swimming around in the river, and what can you say about that? So, Shaw, though, did make one very interesting additional experiment. In doing so, what he did was he took precociously fertile male par. So some par, although we now consider them simply juvenile salmon, become sexually fertile at a very young age, or at least when they're very small creatures. And he bred this precocious male par with an adult salmon. This adult salmon had itself once been a par that he had bred in his ponds. You follow me? So and the issue of this mating were also pars, and they themselves in time turned into salmon. And there's no debate about what a salmon was, everyone would agree. Thus he said, well, he wrote in one of his articles, that by law in the economy of nature, that like produces like, he had proved that the par and the salmon are really identical in species. And his supporters in later years tended to take this specific experiment as the defining experiment in all of his many things he did. And it's an interesting moment, because I think in that shift, you can see something, I don't know, that is a bit like, it reminds me of Foucault and the shift from the grid of classification to the story of descent and relatedness that you know, the biological episteme of the 19th century. Not that I'm suggesting that this gamekeeper in Dumfries had, you know, a great deal to say about that, but... 2 minutes. So I think his language was equally important in doing this shift in the burden of proof onto those who would maintain the existence of the Salmo salmonus. And I'm not alone in thinking this. At least one later naturalist, Jonathan Couch, who actually held out against Shaw's theory, put his success down to both his experiments in reproduction, and his language. So, for example, Shaw was wont to remind naturalists of their creed as empiricists. In his last paper in the series, he quoted Herschel's Discourses, in which the reader is asked to, quote, dismiss his idle prejudice, or at least suspend as premature any preconceived notions of what might or ought to be the order of nature in any proposed case, and content ourselves with observing as a plain matter of fact what is. So he's demonstrating control of this repertoire. And he stressed that the naturalist's honor was bound up with respecting the balanced reporting of facts, wherever they came from, and as gentlemen, they could surely win no honor in despising or patronizing the social inferior. And since he himself claimed, quote, to have no pretensions to scientific attainment, he claimed he was entitled to the indulgence of scientific men. Thus his experiments and his language worked to protect himself from, quote, the charge of crude observation. So here I'm suggesting that there are two reproductive technologies at work, artificial breeding and language, at the interfaces of the social and the factual orders. To the extent that they were successful, the animal, the par, became in turn transformed into a young salmon, or merely a generic name for all young salmonida. The Royal Society of Edinburgh recognised Shaw's work, although he never became a member. They gave him a medal, it was quite prestigious. And he was gradually integrated from this point on into the various correspondence networks of people who studied these fish. So you can see there's a social shift that sort of tracked on to the change in opinions around the factual nature of this creature. And I can end there. How much time do I have? 30 seconds. Okay, well, maybe in the questions I can come to telling you a little bit about what the next step in this controversy was when it became a legal issue as to how we should define this fish or not. I didn't intend to talk about it, but it is interesting.